Mysterious Universe, Season 34, Episode 11. Coming up on this show, we've got a road trip of terror, the rays of the phenomenon, and following the path of the Grail Hunter. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I saw you pick up this book. This is the story of Otto Rahn, isn't it?
Yes, Otto Rahn, the legendary Grail Hunter.
Mm.
And some say the character of Indiana Jones yes. is based on Otto Rahn.
Mm.
He was hired by Himmler in the 1930s to join, what was the Nazi organization?
The Anna Erbe? Was
Anna
that the
Nerbe. They were hunting occult relics.
Yes. Well, they were looking for the Spear of Longinus or the Spear of Destiny, and they thought that if they could attain these, you know, relics, these, you know, rumored relics, if you will, that they could attain the power that was connected to them.
Yeah, and it's part of the mythos with Otto Rahn is that he was sent to the Pyrenees in the late 1930s to hunt down the Holy Grail. And there's a new book that was just released in July from Richard Stanley called Otto Rahn, Grail Hunter, The Secrets of the Cathars and the Return of the White Lady. I've had a physical copy for a while and I hesitated to go into it because I'd read other books on Otto Rahn in the past and they were just a snooze fest.
Mm.
Like too much, just bogged down in all the names of these people from, you know, occult French historians and these people from the 1930s in Germany.
It's like you want a rip-roaring story. You don't want to have to get bogged down in those details.
Too academic.
Yeah.
And I was hesitant to go into this, but to his credit, Stanley has woven in this incredible tale of him trying to trace the footsteps of Otto Rahn and get to the bottom of the real truth behind the story, because there's a lot of mythology surrounding his search for the Grail. And, you know, some of the more extreme versions are that he found the Grail. It gave him eternal life, just like the Indiana Jones movies. And he jumped on a U-boat and went to Antarctica and gave it to Hitler. Like, there's all sorts of crazy stories. But when he actually started to pursue Otto Rahn's research and went to where he went and went to the same locations, he has this incredible experience on this mountaintop with an ancient ruin of a castle. And while he's there, and I'll explain all this in the Plus extension, while he's there, out of nowhere on this perfectly clear summer's day, this storm seems to move at this rapid supernormal pace towards him and his girlfriend who are alone in these ruins on top of the mountain. And this is the site where the Cathars were slaughtered in the 13th century by the army of the Roman Catholic Church. They were considered heretics. Hundreds of them were burnt at the stake at this very site.
Well, they were given the opportunity to renounce their faith, weren't they? And then they decided not to do that.
Yeah, that's right. The dogs of God, the Inquisition, gave them a choice: either convert to the patriarchy of the Catholic Church, or if you want to keep your heretic faith, we'll burn you at the stake. And yeah, like 250 of them took that deal. They said, "Yeah, well, I'll die for my faith." And so when he was up there, he didn't know any of this. He was researching a story for the BBC. They wanted some kind of fun documentary series about the real Indiana Jones. And this had just popped up on his radar. He was there for a day and he said to his girlfriend, "Let's just climb up there and see what happens." But they're overtaken by this storm and it doesn't seem like a normal storm. And they're alone in this ancient courtyard. And he said these strange bolts of plasma, he said it was like a giant hand of plasma reached down from this cloud that came out of nowhere and it started to strike the ruins of the castle they were in. Now, as this is happening, he says he looks into the courtyard and he sees this strange figure, this like hooded, cowled individual with like pale skin and a strange, calm look on his face, almost as if this guy was like a wizard who channeled the storm or was expecting it to strike.
So was it a real figure or was it kind of esoteric?
Well, he's not sure. And as he and his girlfriend, Kat, they tried to flee this storm, they took shelter amongst the ruins. He watched as this guy was like waiting for something as this storm got stronger and stronger. Now, Stanley said, this is back in 1992 when this happened, he said that the walls of the castle started to glow.
Like they were charged by the lightning that had come down?
Something was happening with this ancient site where the wall, the stone, started to go grow in brightness. And he said it got so bright, he thought he was going to be blinded. He couldn't see anything. It was like when you hear an alien abduction story yes. and they're blinded by light. He's surrounded by this white light. And then his girlfriend starts screaming as if she's been taken over by a seizure. Like she's, you know, foaming at the mouth and vibrating violently. He looks over where this guy was standing in this moment of terror, and he sees this hooded figure now engulfed in a beam of light with all these strange, like ephemeral humanoid-like figures dancing around him, like in some ancient ritual.
This is incredible. It's and he just, claims he witnessed this.
I thought this was going to be a bizarre, dry history book.
It sounds more like the Greenstone.
It does, right? And so he drags his girlfriend, who's like screaming in pain. He's terrified. He drags them past this weird guy in the cowl and these circling figures.
Do they acknowledge them? Are they?
No, he's like, they were just ignoring them, these figures. They didn't even pay attention to them. He drags his girlfriend through the entryway so they can get back down the mountain, get away from this storm. And he said, as his girlfriend, Kat, she goes past the threshold of this archway, she has a full-blown seizure again, like something's taking over her body. And when they eventually ascend down the mountain, she starts to get better. But then they get to this plateau where the gradient of the steepness flattens out a bit. And again, she just like flops on the ground and has another seizure. And that's when he realizes where they'd stopped, was where many of the women and children were burnt alive, were killed.
Wow. So there's a lot of energy, spiritual energy kind of contained within this location.
Yeah. And he manages to get her back to the little hostel or wherever they're staying at the foot of the mountain in the village. And she starts screaming at him that he has to fight it and get it out of her.
So something has possessed her?
It's insane. It's this crazy story that's connected to Otto Rahn. It's connected to the history of the Grail. And this guy, just not really knowing any of the history, got caught up with it. And yeah, it sounded like his girlfriend just got randomly possessed on this mountain. And he said as they were fleeing down the mountain, that they could see this like white plasma almost like searching for them, like coming down in a wave off the castle, searching for them.
Now, incredible.
What's interesting about this site is that, yes, it's got like the 13th century built up fortifications, but he mentions briefly like some of the archaeological studies that have been done. It's one of these ancient sites where it's like built upon history, upon history, right. upon history. So before the medieval period, there was something else there. It's probably the Druids. Mm-hmm. Before the Druids, there was something even more ancient there that they built upon.
Yeah, we've often heard this, that there's certain sacred sites that from our perspective seem to be ancient, but we go, oh, well, that's, you know, only 2,000 mm-hmm. years old. And then we find out that beneath them is a previous site that was a revered location. So it's almost like somehow different cultures through their shamanic practices, if you will, or spiritual practices, understand the power of these particular locations. Yeah. And that's why they build structures in those locations.
Yeah. And one of the other people that was traveling with him was Mike D from the 14 Times, a writer in the UK. And Mike, who, you know, wasn't unaccustomed to the high strangeness of things, he was halfway up the mountain with the both of them, with Stanley and his girlfriend, Kat. And Mike D just suddenly said to them, give me the keys to the car. I'm going back.
He just felt something was off.
Yeah, it was really out of character. They said, what's wrong? He said, I just need to go back. I can't go up this mountain. I need to go back. Took the keys and left. And they're like, what's his deal?
Well, I mean, I'd imagine, you know, working in this particular field, he's probably, as you pointed out, being exposed to this kind of stuff. You have this innate knowing, I think. It's almost like you become... It's the opposite of acclimatized. It's like you become, you acquire an allergy to it. It's like you know that there's something not right and you just got to get the hell out of there.
Yeah, it's like he could sense that something was awry. And so later again, when Stanley's in the region, he's at a campsite and one of these hooded hermit guys turns up, very strange, doesn't really speak any language that they can, you know, converse him with him. But what's interesting is Otto Rahn, when he was there in the 1930s, he also encountered one of these hermit-like individuals dressed in the, you know, traditional garb, who claimed to be part of this secret society that had obtained this knowledge passed down verbally from master to disciple.
So almost like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Yes, and basically gave Otto Rahn the secrets to the Grail. So it's a little bit crazy. It's a little bit wild.
Awesome.
But super fun. Well, that's coming up in PLOS.
Sounds like it will actually dovetail really nicely with some of the stories that I'm going to get into on this episode, because on the last PLOS episode, we covered that book, and the book was The Orb Incident, A True Account by E.B. David. This was actually written by Reinhard Denke. But basically, he speaks to, you go back and listen to the episode. I'll link to it in the show notes so you can check it out. Or even better, pick up the book, because it's...
it was good.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. But it really inspired me, actually, for this episode, where I was kind of taken aback by this guy's experience, in the sense that, look, very, very long story short, and go back and listen or read the book yourself, but essentially 1982, he's hanging out with this girl, just a friend, not a girlfriend. They go down to a river. When they go down to the river, they find that there's this eerie luminescent green glow kind of encompassing the entire area. He's like, oh, that's odd. And they look up and there's an enormous orb kind of floating there, giving off this neon green, unearthly kind of color. And both of them stay. Like, they, at first, they're filled with euphoria and they think it's good. And then they get this feeling, much like what you were describing there, Ben, that they have to get out of there.
Yeah, half an hour they watched it before they got this antsy feeling.
And they didn't leave. They kind of played cat and mouse with it and stared this thing down. Now, all of a sudden, this guy, you know, without giving it away, but this guy got a lifetime of health implications from interacting with this thing.
Well, the episode was one-shotted or headshot from the orb.
I mean, it's, at the very least, it seems like some type of radiation beam or something similar had been fired into his temple and it caused, you know, a lifetime of issues. And one thing, because I didn't read the book, I was only just listening to what you were describing, Ben. But you pointed out that there was a certain air of arrogance about, well, I don't actually believe in UFOs, or I don't think that this is, you know, UFOs. It's like there was something that was just kind of, and we spoke about it.
There was just a general feeling of they were both looking down their noses at the UFO topic, as in it's full of crazy people, but our UFO story is the not crazy one.
Yeah.
It's like we're different because we're, you know, we're sane. With everyone else that experiences UFOs is obviously crazy. I'm not... like, that's paraphrasing, obviously.
Of course,
but it had that feeling to it that they didn't take it seriously, even though it had happened to them.
Well, I think there was also an element of fear in there that he was wanting to explore what occurred to him, but didn't know how to go about it. And but that goes further to why I was inspired to talk about what I'm going to do on today's show, because it's like this stuff, I mean, it's coming out. It's coming. People are going, oh, you know, years later, you know, I'm willing to talk about this kind of stuff. But the reality is this has been happening for decades. And the problem is that interactions with this stuff is not good. And I see this change that's happening, is particularly with the UAP phenomenon and this whole idea of it's a good idea to summon in UFOs. It's a good idea to interact with these things. It's absolutely not. It is absolutely, no matter how good it feels, no matter how these beings present themselves, no matter how the phenomenon interacts with you, ultimately what happens every single time is it leads to devastating effects upon the human.
Our conclusion at the end of that story was, well, this is another case to add to the reason that, well, if you see an orb, run.
Run.
Don't
run.
Hang out to observe or interact. Run.
Well, let's start, right? Okay, so I happened to see this article come up in the MUFON journal. You know, MUFON do great work. They publish their monthly journal. This is from 2025. So from July of this year, you've got a report in here by David Kreiter, and David Kreiter investigated this directly. He called it Terror on Iowa Highway 169. And it relates to this 52-year-old Des Moines, Iowa witness who apparently was working for like a courier company, a medical company of some kind. And he had to pick up a package from a regional health center. And this was in Algona. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, in Iowa. This was on March the 28th in 2024.
Oh, it's a recent case.
Very recent, right? He's heading south along US Highway 169. It's approximately 2 o'clock in the morning. Apparently, the package that he picked up contained blood samples, and it was destined for the LifeServe Blood Center in Des Moines, Iowa. And basically, this is a donation and distribution center for blood products.
So he's in a van carrying blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've heard one of these stories before.
Of course you have, because if you think
a giant claw comes out of a UFO and,
well, that's
and tries
the thing
to take it.
So John Keel published in Strange Creatures from Time and Space the report of Bo Schwertzer. So Bo was the son of Bob Schwertzer, Back on March the 5th in 1967, he was 21 years old. He was working for the Red Cross.
This is the one I'm thinking of,
right? This is the one you're thinking of. He and a young nurse had been collecting human blood, and they were on the, you know, traveling along a rainy morning. They were transporting the specimens back to the Red Cross in Huntington. They were driving along Route 2 between Point Pleasant and Huntington. So Point Pleasant, a location that's already associated with a lot of strange paranormal activity. From behind a nearby hill, a large glowing object lifted into the air and swoops down upon them over the Bloodmobile. Now, Bo rolls down the window to try and get a better look at this craft. He says the van kept pace with this weird orb that was flying along with them. But then he realized that it wasn't an orb, it was something else. It was something that really could be described as a UFO. And he said attached to this UFO was some type of claw. It was like it was a gigantic version of an arcade crane game trying to grab the van. Now, this sounds very like Mars Attacks. It's like this cliche UFO
like
kind of
literally the Japanese arcade game of the claw coming
down. Now he stepped on the gas. He tried to gun it, but couldn't outpace this craft. This is what always happens with these things. They're capable of not only matching, but exceeding our speed. They don't seem to be affected by inertia the way that we are, obviously, because they're highly advanced craft. The nurse was in this state of shock and she was freaked out. They managed to get away from this thing. But, you know, Keel lists this case, not for the fact that it's like certainly an outlier, but it is the height of high strangeness because of the fact that it was chasing after blood. Like, did it want something that was inside the Bloodmobile? Was it going for those samples or was it something else? And, you know, I've spoken about in the past this weird connection between paranormal phenomena, whether it's UFOs or, you know, cryptozoology or anything else in this field, and blood, right? This weird connection between blood.
Well, it goes back to the fairy folklore and then you extend it to the alien abduction program where they're supposedly taking DNA and reproductive material.
Well, it refers to genetic material, but I think it's something else. I think it's something more spiritual. It's like this whole idea and blood in itself, even a scientific term, could be described as a life force, right? It is because it allows you to pump, you know, gases throughout your body, which are essential to health. But I think from a more spiritual standpoint, a paranormal or supernatural standpoint, it's definitely connected with something that they're trying to get hold of, this life force. And then you hear really crazy outlying cases like blood cults, for example, in Puerto Rico that are utilizing blood of donors to summon chupacabras and it needs the blood to be able to manifest. I'll find that story and link to that as well. I won't go over it here because I don't have enough time. But you know these sorts of stories, right? There's something connected to blood. So when I hear a 2024 case of a guy driving along collecting blood samples, it gets my attention. And immediately you're right, because within the first two paragraphs, Ben, both of us had the same reaction of like, I've heard this story before. Like, and immediately we thought the same case.
Is it just a copycat story?
And that's what I thought with this, because the story, don't get me wrong, and I want you to withhold your belief with this particular story. But at first, immediately I was the same. I'm like, is this guy, he knows the literature, he's driving with blood samples. What a great way to tell this incredible story. But this time, unlike back in the 60s, we've got a whole heap of GPS data connected to mobile phones and cell phones and cell phone towers to back it up. So if the guy was faking it, he's gone to an enormous amount of effort, including sending what would appear to be falsified information to, you know, tracking systems.
What kind of data do you have?
So he's got GPS locations. He's got the time intervals.
What does it show?
Well, I'll get to that. Okay. Like, I'll get to that because we need to look at the images first. So let's go back to what was happening to this man, this 52-year-old worker, as he's driving along this highway. He's driven this highway numerous times, you know, several times a week for 3 years. So he knows this highway. It's a mundane kind of drive. He's just doing his duty. Now, his sister was an administrator and dispatcher for the same company that was doing a blood delivery near Waterloo in Iowa. She had phoned her brother and they were on the phone the entire trip. She was actually just keeping him company, talking about a family matter that was going on. And the witness says this, as soon as I pulled out of the hospital parking lot, I noticed four lights of different colors following me in the distance on the roadway behind me. Again, very cliche, very, you know, a salesman driving along late at night with a UFO following him. He said, I was telling my sister on the phone, it's weird. It looks like there's something following me. It looks like a car, but it's not. It's a weird light if it's a car. And then he said, my sister replied back, probably the lights from the town. He said, I told my sister, there's no way. I've been out of town for a bit and traveling up and down this distance and these curves. These lights are staying the same distance. So it's not stationary lights. It appears to be a vehicle of some kind. Now, if not this image, Ben, if you can put up for me the...
Give me a number.
I think I must have... It's number one, mirror.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah. So put this up. So what he does is he takes a photograph of these lights in the distance and then sends it to his sister. He says, I could see these things in the mirror and I thought, you know, what are they? They're behaving very strange.
So it's a photograph of his rearview mirror or his side mirror.
Correct.
With a couple of lights. I mean, nothing.
Like, there's potentially three or four, maybe five lights, maybe six lights you can see there, unless that's, you know, just artifacts from the photography. You really can't see anything in it, right? But his sister zooms in on it. I think she zooms in on that red one in the middle there, Ben. Now, of course, if you're not watching the video, don't worry. All these photographs and images that I'm talking about, I'll link to in the show notes. If you just go to the show notes for this episode, they'll be there as well.
Is this in the next image?
So, well, hang on a second. I'll bring up the next image in one moment because she zooms in and she says, I can see objects. There's faces. Get the hell out of there.
Come on, dude.
So bring this up. Now, this, I think personally, is a case of pareidolia.
Yeah, like, of course.
So she zooms in on this image and she claims that this is what you can... And at first, and I saw it as well...
Well, you're just seeing digital artifacts. I mean, that's all you're seeing.
Yeah. Yeah, look, and in the particular article, so in the MUFON journal, there's other images as well where it's being cropped and kind of zoomed in again. I'll link to that article so you can go and see it for yourself because I don't want to publish them all here. You know, I want MUFON to be able to, you know, get their stuff out. But this is the closest image that we have of this, right? So, yeah, what to make of it? But clearly the guy's freaked out. Like, the guy's uncomfortable with that, with what is going on. He continues his journey down US 169. He reaches the town of Humboldt in Iowa, which is about 20 minutes into the journey. And at this moment, he starts to experience all kinds of bizarre activity. He claims that 50 orbs fell from the sky, landing behind him in the fields, as well as a huge white square-looking object that sat in the center of the highway behind him. He says this, I got off the phone to my sister, and I'd had enough of this, he swore. I pulled over off the road, jumped out of my vehicle and screamed, leave me alone. He says, I noticed a white square-looking object in the middle of the road, three orb-looking things to the right of the vehicle and one behind, and an orb-like thing taking off to the left and moving around the road behind me. Then these orbs seemed to dissipate or lose their roundness. Then they turned into these weird animal-looking things.
What?
Okay. So these orbs falling around him, they're now shape-shifting. Now, normally I would dismiss this. It's like, this is just bat. Like, it's just BS. Like, it's way over the top. I mean, come on. But we do know of plenty of cases of people reporting encounters with shape-shifting orbs. They change into animals. You know, the whole Merrily Harpore has reported this about in Big Cats on the Loose in Great Britain. Nick Redfern has reported these sorts of encounters across the US.
Wouldn't be the first time.
Linda Godfrey.
We'd have an eyewitness saying this, yeah.
Exactly, with Dogman.
So it's almost as if the photography that's been given makes it less believable.
I know. And then that ties back into this thing I talk about, how it's like the phenomenon that people experience, it almost like it deliberately makes people look like they're faking it because it adds this kind of thing where people will dismiss it and there's no way to prove it. And it loves this. It loves to evade any type of proof.
Is the next image connected to this case?
Yeah, it is, okay. Right? So he says, the orbs seemed to dissipate and then turn into animal-looking things. My attention was now focused on one of the orbs, this animal-looking entity that was in a crouched position, ready to take off running, and it seemed to have these glowing eyes or a mask. I took a picture and jumped back into my Equinox and sped off as fast as I could, but now the chase was on. So bring up this next image because this is the photograph that he took. Now, I don't know. He claims that these are the orbs that were shape-shifting, right?
Traffic lights, anyone?
That's what I don't know.
Other cars?
Well, look, the red lights, I imagine, are they road markers, you know, along the side of the road?
Yeah, I mean,
The things on the right-hand side, though, the green, the orange, the white and the blue and even the grey colours, I'm not sure what to make. The only thing I could imagine is, like, it seems like that is, again, that shutter effect where it's like a slow shutter speed.
We've got nothing to compare it against. If he had this stretch of highway, you know, the way it normally looks, according to him, at least we could have something to compare it to, but this could be anything.
Right. So let's listen to his story because he claims that one of the animal orb-looking things that morphed into whatever it was now on the side of his vehicle. He said it streaked across to the opposite side of the road, meeting my speed while many orbs were coming out of the sky on both sides of me. They were falling in the fields and then directly behind me. The orb that was following me slammed into the rear door on my driver's side, and there was now an orb inside my vehicle.
It's trying to get the blood.
He was back on the phone to his sister, and he yelled, "It's in my vehicle!" My vehicle was getting hit by other orbs, and it seemed as if they were trying to push me off the road. My sister could not only hear me yelling into the phone, she could also hear the thumping and the sound of my vehicle being hitting the rumble strips on the side of the road.
Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections oder Excel-Superkräfte?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Ich fühle mich plötzlich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Abgabefrist 31. Juli.
Was?
Schaffst du ganz entspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
Ach, ja.
So I'm like, okay, well, this is intriguing. The witness apparently went on to state the following. I drove, it seemed like forever, and I came upon a semi-trailer in the road. I told my sister, I can see a semi, and I kept my speed up until I got closer to the driver's rear end. I started to pass the semi when my sister said, what are you doing? I replied, I'm trying to pass it. She said, stay behind it, but I told her that she was nuts and I wanted to feel safe and get in front of it. Orbs were passing me on the side so fast and low that I thought they were the lights of oncoming cars. So, and I get that, right? He's trying to get around and he's kind of looking, as you do behind a semi, you know, you're kind of looking to see if you can get around these orbs. It's almost like they know what they're doing. They're preventing him from being able to do it. But he said, every time I tried to pass the semi, it looked like there was a car coming, but it wasn't. It was the orbs. I told my sister that they're expletive with me. I sped past the semi and I could see the driver. When I passed him, I slowed down to meet his speed and then I was finally in front of him. But as soon as I was in front of him, the semi and the trailer vanished.
So, I either thought that the driver of the semi would be an orb, like a little trucker cap on, just looks over and there's an orb driver.
Right. He said, as soon as I was in front of him, the semi and the trailer vanished. I was screaming to my sister on the phone, the semi disappeared. It's gone. Now, look, again, this seems absurd.
Does he have a photo of the semi not being there
anymore?
No,
he doesn't. Yeah, well, yeah, he's got a photo of the road, right, ready to go. He said, at this time, I could see a ton of orbs dropping out of the sky. 50 was my best guess from both the mirrors and the rearview mirror. He said, I drove as fast as I could that the Equinox would let me. It was this weird feeling that suddenly came over me. I didn't feel right inside. I wasn't sick, but certainly weird. And I'm like,
so you said this was submitted to MUFON.
Yeah.
Was it investigated by MUFON?
Yes,
so
yes.
There was a follow-up?
There was a case that was investigated. So this was investigated by David Crater. It was CMS 141236. And like this is what I was saying, which I'll get to. He's done his due diligence here. Like he's done a lot of effort to look into this stuff with the data from the cell phone, which is really, really intriguing.
Yeah, that's what interests me. So you're claiming, what I presume you're going to present is the GPS data is showing that he moved a distance that he couldn't have.
That's correct.
Or did he go up and down?
No, none of that was included. There was an accelerometer information that was included, but I'd imagine you could probably pull that as well. More so it's that just the GPS information showing that he was on that road at that particular time. He was talking to his sister because that phone call data is there as well. So he's gone to a lot of effort to make this up, right?
Yep.
And the photographs as well, they've got all the GPS information in them and all the camera data in them, all the EXIF.
Okay, so what is it about the data that makes any of it anomalous?
Well, I'll get to that, right? So this is what, just telling you the remainder of what happens to him, because he's fitting, like he's ticking all the boxes of an abduction scenario, but it's got this weird kind of light show attached to it and this disappearing. But what's going on? He says, I'm not feeling right. He said, my vehicle speakers were humming and distorting when I was talking to my sister. She could hear this. I told her I don't feel right. I don't think I'm going to make it. Tell my family I love them. Like he was apparently fearful for his life. He said, then my right shoulder was pushed down and I could feel something enter my body from my shoulder.
Ugh.
I heard these words come out of my mouth. Tad, Tad. Don't know what that means, like why you would say that. I looked out my rearview mirror and I could see a bright white object speeding down the center of the road, taking up both sides. I told my sister something is coming and it looks the size of a double wide garage. So this is a lot. I reckon this is the actual like mothership, the large craft, as opposed to all this other weird stuff. He said the speakers continued to hum and distort as the object flew over the rear of his vehicle. He said, I felt that I had no control of the vehicle. And this is the last memory I had until I reached somewhere safe in Grimes, Iowa, and found myself at a gas station. I'd lost over an hour of memory.
Right. I was going to ask if there was missing time.
Definitely. He said, I had not a clue about the rest of the drive. And this is what we were describing in the orb story, is that what we weren't describing was described by the witness, is that after they have this weird encounter with the orb and they black out, they find themselves, because they were attending a school, in the cafeteria the next morning.
Right.
And they find themselves going, hang on a second. how did I even get to breakfast?
Yeah, that was a great part of the story. He starts to freak out because he's got no memory.
Neither of them
getting
do.
To the cafeteria. He's just suddenly there.
Just suddenly coming to. And this is repeated in this case. I thought, that's very strange. He says, I have no memory of the rest of the drive from Livermore, Iowa to Grimes, Iowa to get gas. I remember getting out of the vehicle in Grimes and I left the driver's side door open while my sister was on the phone. I could still hear her over the speakers of my vehicle. And as I look west, I saw all these lights line up and flash at me. He said, I still went in and paid for gas and then drove off heading to LifeServe. At this time, I felt scared. My sister asked me if they were still following me and I replied, I don't know. But I remember the sun was starting to show itself. So it's like, he has got a large period of missing time where it's like, what has happened?
And that's on the map there. That's from Livermore to Grimes.
Yes.
So it's a 2-hour drive.
That image is actually shown. There's a map and a path that he had driven that was included in the MUFON article.
So I presume we're going to get data that shows that he made that journey in much less than an hour and 57 minutes.
That's just the thing, no.
Really?
Yeah. That's the crazy thing, right? So he said to his sister, scroll down here. Where am I? I've just lost my place. No, right. So he finally gets to his location where he's supposed to be after going to the gas station, refueling. He pulls into LifeServe, which is where he was to make his delivery. And that's where his sister was.
Okay.
And apparently people were saying, what's wrong with Chad? We don't have his full name. It's just Chad is his name. And apparently he says, my sister said, don't ask. He's had a bad experience this morning. Now, several days later, the witness reviewed the photos on his phone. I don't know why he took a few days, but then that's also fitting with what a lot of abductees, pardon me, and people that have these experiences describe. He said he'd taken around 50 photos, but he doesn't remember taking those photos. Like he has no recollection of it.
Okay.
He said the last photo the witness remembered taking was the photo he took before he stopped the car and got out. Because of this, he believes that he had missing time. Yet his sister, and this is really important, was talking to him for the entire 2.5-hour journey.
Huh?
So the question is, did he suffer some type of alien-induced amnesia? Like, why is it? So he doesn't have missing time in the traditional sense that you normally hear missing time where someone finds that they've arrived at a location, as you pointed out, you know, faster than they should, or that normally it'd be a journey where they would, use up half a tank of fuel. Like it's a journey that people would take regularly. They'd know how much fuel's taken up, and yet they haven't used any fuel.
Yeah.
And that's consistent with other reports I was looking into. There's many reports that are scattered amongst the literature of people that actually say that their vehicles are picked up. Like they're picked up by a beam of light somehow, and then they lose control of the vehicle. The vehicle's being controlled by something else and it's taken, a long way.
So again, though, what makes the data interesting?
Right. So he was so traumatized by this that he actually quit his job. And this is how bad it was for him. During the following year as well, he was plagued with other encounters and strange happenings. It doesn't say what they were, though, but I'm like, again, this fits with so many of these cases that we hear. It took him a year to file this report with MUFON. And of course, MUFON investigated it and they found that this witness, is reliable. In fact, he says this case is extraordinary for many reasons. First, the witness and his sister's character were beyond reproach. In my conversations with them over the past couple of months, their accounts of what happened on that fateful night never changed, and neither the witness nor his sister attempted to embellish their story in any way. Now, secondly, this is what David Kreider writes, metadata from the photographs that the witness took during his trip include GPS coordinates that meshed perfectly with the testimony indicating where he took those photographs and the date and time that they were taken.
Oh, okay.
So using EXIF time and GPS data, he found these facts. The witness used an Apple iPhone 13 with an aperture of f1.6. The location data was turned on, therefore GPS data was available. Photos were analyzed with forensic information or forensic photograph software. There was no cloning and no manipulation of the photos. What I found to be the most compelling was that the GPS was what the GPS data captured. It told me that between the two pictures showing the entities out the front window, that they were taken 7 seconds apart with a vehicle traveling 634 feet for an average of 62 miles per hour. The entities seemed to be in similar formation, appearing larger, but only moving about 6 feet towards the west side of the road. The GPS data shows a speed of 40 miles per hour in each photo. So these things are moving at a speed which is not as fast as the vehicle, but it's suggestive that it's more than just lights that have been stationary on the side of the road, which he's taking a photograph of. Now, did he take a photograph of some vehicle?
So we're obviously missing some photos here because we've just got the one, but he's comparing, 50. For example, the one. Okay, so he's comparing the one we've got on the screen with Correct. Several others showing these lights in different positions.
So this was handed over, these photographs were handed over to a coordinator and photo analysis team with MUFON. There was a Seth Feinstein. He's an analyst. He said, call me crazy, but I think that this witness has evidence in the street image, which along with his sister's testimony supports his story. The rolling shutter camera artifact is prominent in this image. Photo forensics show what could be evidence of ant-like and large cranium species of alien figures.
What?
So I was like, that's a bit of a jump.
Hang on, are we missing some photos here? Because I'm not seeing the ant people in this image. Where is it in this image?
Right. Yeah. I'm like, that's a bit of a jump just to there. But
honestly, are we? What are we missing though? Did you have access to any of the other images?
No,
just this one.
These are just the images. There's a few more images that are included in the article, but there's nothing else that's included in this. So look, I'm leaving this one as I'm skeptical, but intrigued. And the fact that a MUFON investigator is putting his name next to it and saying, well, look, we were able to analyze this data and it does demonstrate that, yeah, like these photographs were taken. And they do appear to show something which is moving at a certain speed. I'm not very familiar with photographic analysis, but, you know, I am an amateur photographer. And looking at that, I'm like, if he was taking a photograph at a really like slow shutter speed, you could get that effect, but it'd have to be extremely slow. And unless he's using specified software on his phone, which would have shown that.
Yeah, in the data.
The data would have shown that, and it doesn't. So it is
strange. I mean, you're right,
strange.
Though. The fact that he you know, lost his job and had all these, I guess, tribulations in his life after the initial counter, it does follow the trend. You remember from the last story we did on that weird green orb that was sighted, he had to quit university. He locked himself in his dorm room, had to bring up food and eat in his dorm room, couldn't face anyone else, couldn't talk to anyone else. And it was really just this pattern that we've seen time and time again, where this phenomenon just ruins people's lives. It completely destroys their lives. And they suffer from PTSD. He's going through PTSD.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I was, you know, trying to highlight with these sorts of stories is that, you know, I commonly complain that like these sorts of encounters don't really happen to people anymore. And I was wrong because they happen quite frequently. And this guy was so traumatized by it that apparently it took him a year to report it.
And the interesting thing with E.B. David's story in the orb incident that we covered on the last Plus show was that he had all these symptoms of PTSD and he was reacting as if he had gone through some terrifying trauma. But he had no idea what that trauma was because it was all this missing time.
Right.
And he was forever wondering, why am I scared? Like he, later on in the book, we talked about how he wouldn't be able to be near an open, dark doorway.
Yeah.
Because he had a feeling that something was non-human would be in that doorway, even though he never saw it in his waking life. He always just had that fear and he couldn't understand where that fear had come from.
Well, what I find to be so unusual about this, and it's not reported here what was said by the sister, but like we do know from this report that she had been speaking to him the entire trip. So what happened in that hour of missing time? Like was he
How
was
could
he
there
quiet?
Be any missing time if she's talking to him the whole time?
Well, he has no, when I say missing time,
he just blacks
time,
out.
He has an hour of blacked out memory.
Mm.
So it's like, what did she hear in that time? And was he talking? Was he not talking?
Was she talking? Surely to a simulacrum or something?
That's what I'm wondering. I'm like, because we were just talking as well about voices of the paranormal and how these things can manipulate, especially spirits, but you know, possibly alien entities. They can mimic voices. They can interfere with electrical devices. They can change. Like, is that what happened? I don't know what to make of this case, but I will keep an eye on it because I find it to
be interesting.
Very intriguing. But the one thing that grabbed me as well, though, is that something entered him. Something got in his body.
Yeah, that's right.
In the shoulder. And I'm like, you don't hear that very often in UFO reports. But then again, it is out there. And just completely serendipitously, I found this great write-up from the Oz Files. Now, the Oz Files, of course, is the blog of Bill Chalker. The great Bill Chalker. It's a small world because my neighbor actually went to school with him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I was like, that's so weird. But anyway, he was like, Bill Chalker, of course, like we talk about many ufological researchers, they don't go into the field just because of a whim, right? Normally something happens to them, whether they're willing to admit it or not. But stories had come out about Bill Chalker, right? That had been a little bit sensationalized a few years back, maybe a year or so back, of where Bill Chalker himself had a UFO encounter. right? And he's like, well, look, I want to set the record straight about what happened. Yes, I encountered a UFO, but look, the any consideration, he writes here, of the UFO problem was far from my mind at twilight on September the 15th in 1972. So he says, I was returning from a chemistry practical class and, you know, weighing on his mind was the thought of dinner and a chance to relax after an exhausting day. But he says, as he was walking along the college grounds, he said it was around 5:50 in the afternoon and his attention was drawn to two students that were not known to him, but they were intent on looking at something in the sky. So, of course, when people are, you know, it's different if people are just looking up, but there was this intention behind it. And he said, I was curious, so I turned in the direction of their gazes and saw what appeared to be a metallic egg-shaped object traversing the twilight sky from north to south. It was moving in a horizontal trajectory. It was at a speed roughly equitable to that of a low-flying light plane. He said, this object was in my view for about 15 seconds until it was obscured by college buildings. I rushed through the college buildings and out the other side, which afforded a clear panoramic view for some considerable distance. And to my surprise, the aerial object was gone. So I'm like, well, this is something again. Like, this is not a light plane. Yeah, planes can, you know, zip away and disappear maybe if
not
they
a
change.
University engineering project?
No.
Some kind of drone?
No. This is something else. But he says, I was puzzled because UFOs had been in the news that week, but much of the overall coverage was of a dubious nature. And I mean, even though this is the 70s, I guarantee you whatever was the precursor to X-Files music was being played on Australian television back in 1972 when people were talking about this stuff. Like,
well, Twilight Zone music.
Yeah, Twilight Zone music, exactly. He said the focus of the media attention was on a bright silvery light that had been observed on several consecutive mornings at Taree on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. And he said, you know, Sydney papers around that time were having a field day with it, complete with front page photos and headlines about the aerial mystery. But of course, like, it's not reliable. Plenty of people were saying that this was Venus, you know, all that kind of tabloid stuff that was coming out. But he does point out, he says, this particular area does have intriguing activity taking place. And he said it didn't get the attention that it deserved. So it was like almost like this particular event was detracting the media that was all like sensationalized and silly away from something very real that was taking place just west of Armidale at a location known as Mount Butler. He says, earlier on the same day of my sighting, a student told me of some unusual events that had occurred at 3 a.m. that morning on a property to the west of Armidale and apparently involving a bizarre apparition looking like a monk in a shroud. The student was acquainted with me through meetings of the fledgling University Psychic Phenomena Society.
That's my story.
There you go, right? He said, I've been co-opted as chair of its ghost and poltergeist subcommittee. Awesome. This is great. He said, which I saw an opportunity to catch all manner of fringe phenomena. So he said he wanted to clarify more of these details. And he said, you know, he was asking about this apparitional form. But he said he found out that this particular location where this apparitional form had appeared, it seemed to possess this site, and this site was known to be haunted by UFOs. Mm. An interesting way of describing it, you know, to say that it's haunted by UFOs. The entire Mount Butler affair seems to be connected within the depths of the dimensions of the UFO problem. And of course, it's far from clear what the best approach would be to deal with this. So he emailed some people that were connected to it. And this is in more modern times, right? This isn't back in the 1970s, but he wanted to follow up on it. And of course, you know, many years has passed and, you know, obviously things can change and it's a little bit difficult. But he says, look, circumstances will prevent a proper investigation from being completed. This was at the end of 1973. But he says there was something more strange going on at Mount Butler, that it was something that was far more odd than just simply the encounter with a bizarre entity. He said this area was definitely the focus of UFO activity, but it seemed to center around one individual. And I thought, oh, here we go. Like, this is where it starts crossing
What's
into.
What's this guy been doing?
You know, that's what I'm wondering. I'm like, are you summoning something? I know it's the 70s, but were you summoning something? Were you doing something spiritual? Were you involved in an occult group? You've already got some cowled figure showing up and UFO lights going on. What are you doing? So he writes, during the early morning darkness of September the 15th, which is the same day as his sighting, three university students were in their lodgings at the Mount Butler property. They're engaging in conversation and listening to music. A commotion was heard amongst the farm animals outside, and of course, one of them went to investigate. When he saw what was causing all of the commotion, he called the others outside. There, Floating in a slow semicircle near the house was a monk-like apparition. No limbs were noted and a black void was present where the face would have been. But this has got hallmarks going back to what we were describing, what you just pointed out, Ben, with the orb encounter. Mm. Now, they're seeing like something you can't make out the face. And he says one of the students, Greg, apparently made a sudden move and the other two thought they saw the apparition vanish in a flash of light. It was their impression that this flash had actually traveled towards Greg and had entered him at chest height. Puzzled, the two men went over to Greg and found him in a much distressed state. He was shaking almost uncontrollably and was inarticulate, except for garbled attempts to convey that he was really sick inside.
Yeah, that's what the eyewitness to the orb in the last story on Plus on Tuesday experienced. He described it as a silver orb flying directly at him.
And almost to a T, this matches the scenario from Iowa, of where he said something pushed down on his shoulder and entered him, and he felt very uncomfortable inside. Apparently, two of the horses galloped up to meet them. One of them, Greg's favorite, came up to see him. The other two students said they saw another flash of light leave Greg, enter the horse, and then leave it before dissipating finally into the night. The horse reared up and fled. So it's like it's a possessing entity.
It's just checking you out. It's doing a full colonic cleanse.
A spiritual colonic cleanse, Graham, another student, started living on the property during the 1970s, 1973. He also began to see strange sights, particularly since he started finishing late, working as a cleaner in town. During 1973, which was, again, this particular year as well, globally was a hotbed of UFO activity, but he had at least 8 UFO sightings that year.
Wow.
Bill writes that I found his retelling convincing as he took me to each location that was involved. One unknown to him provided me with a sense of authentication for his experiences.
Is this connected to the Turingum sightings?
What's the Turingum sightings? It might be, actually.
Because on the blog where he's writing about this, he's got other images from 1973, a different town.
It is. Yes, it is. It is connected to that. Yeah, I'm not familiar with this particular area, but you're right. It is Turingum.
And are you going to talk about those?
The Dundarabin hot zone? No, I'm not really going to go
into
that.
Because I wanted to flash up the images, but I didn't want to ruin your story. But that's right. One of the sightings nearby from 1973. And isn't it strange? This was the year with all the weirdness in France.
And Pennsylvania.
The humanoid sightings that occurred in Europe. It was the year. 1973 was the year.
Yeah, it's really weird. I'll link to this particular blog because it does have all that stuff much later on. I just wanted to include these particular parts.
Okay, yeah.
But you know what I found to be quite telling about these sorts of encounters is that, again, it's like these particular areas, especially in the 1970s, I mean, look how isolated that is. They're isolated locations where you can easily just be the only person for miles around.
Unsealed dirt road, middle of nowhere.
In the bush.
Yeah.
Like, and that doesn't look that dense there, but I promise you the Australian bush, when you're down amongst it, can get very thick and it's very easy for you to either get lost or be obscured from the view of other people. So that makes me think, well, is there some nefarious reason for that? That's why people interact with these things. But going back to what Bill was writing, he said late in March of 1973, this particular witness, I think this was Graham, he was coming home from university around 1:30 a.m. after completing a radio program as part of the student radio network. He drove out of town along Bundara Road. He turned to the left onto a road that eventually leads to the Mount Butler property, where obviously all this other activity had been taking place. Just as he passed the university ionosphere research receiver, I'm like, okay, well, you've got this weird light activity. I don't know if you're messing with the ionosphere. Does that have anything to do with it? But this is a grid system of metal poles. He said he stopped to answer the call of nature. And he said that I was just sort of looking at the sky and I noticed that the sky was sort of shifting, the sky itself. There was 5 or 6 lights in it and it was moving slowly in a curve formation in an arc. It was sort of fractionally moving. It lasted for about 5 minutes. Then all of a sudden, they just all start to slide around in the arc into a straight line, and then they accelerated towards the south. This was also picked up by reports from a UFO research group in Sydney. So it's being seen the same night by other witnesses and researched by other groups in that area. So this isn't just, and this is why Bill was saying it provides validation, because it wasn't just this guy that saw it. Mm. It was picked up by other people. Graham also, and of course, this gives Graham some, credence, because he also saw 2 other different types of UFOs on a number of occasions. Golden balls, and what he labeled as green plasma balls. Once he saw three of these golden balls jumping around the tops of trees, they appeared to zoom about each other for about a 10-minute period. The green lights were often closer but seemed to be generally short of duration. The first time he saw one of these, it was very vivid to him. It seemed to be spinning a circular mass about 2 meters in diameter, which zoomed across the trees in front of him. He said he smelt burnt air, almost like possibly ozone, and observed a sort of light trail. Graham thought that the green plasmic balls and a sort of green comet were only about 100 meters away and 10 meters in the air. And he said about 2 weeks later, all the leaves along the sides of where this ball had passed were now brown, leaving a very clear trail that lasted for months.
Stay away from the green ones.
Yeah, and this is a thing.
They got the cancer lasers.
Yeah, pretty much. Bill writes that other unusual phenomena had also occurred at the farm, which would possibly fall into the concept of earth energy type episodes. One involved an early evening experience, the strangest day. It was called When the Mountain Spoke, obviously in inverted commas, but apparently a distinct humming sound turned into a bush chant, impacting upon three people who experienced a tremendous feeling of euphoria.
Oh, weird.
Going back to the orb case that we were just talking about.
Yeah, so in the orb case from the last show, he mentioned that for decades after he'd had this orb encounter, he would have a dream where he'd be sitting in his parents' kitchen table and essentially a UFO would come over, but it would be preceded by a hum. And it was this hum and the coming of this object that would send him into this euphoric state of ecstasy.
Yep.
And he looked forward to these dreams every day because they would just give him this feeling that he never wanted to leave, this pure ecstatic bliss.
And you have a very similar, not identical, but similar report coming from a remote part of Australia. It's very unusual.
Again, it just goes to show, if these stories are true, the malleability of human beings, how
absolutely
easily our emotional states can be changed and affected.
Well, you're really highlighting where I'm going with this because, you know, recently one of the terms I've been using is like the field that is generated by these things that creates a euphoria, but it's a field of control, like it exerts some type of psychological influence over the witness.
And it's the same thing with abductions, where the eyewitnesses feel like, oh, everything's okay. They felt benevolent. It's like this hideous 10-foot-tall insect praying mantis thing that's about to slice your arm off, but oh, it feels so benevolent.
Yeah, it's so wonderful. And then they, you know, flash a whole heap of images of nuclear war in your head, tell you you're important, and then kick you out of the flying saucer. Yeah.
Shove you out the exit tube.
After they've, you know, taken something from you. But he says, yeah, the whole mountain, the entire hillside, he said, was singing in a choir, even though it's not that, but that's what it felt like to Graham. He said the others felt a sense of communication that was coming from this. And as they came down off the mountainside and returned to the barn area of the property, apparently they said that they witnessed 10 falling stars zooming across the evening sky. So they're not falling stars. This is some type of light activity that is connected. Surely it's connected to this. The group distinctly said this was far stranger than the typical Australian bush hum. And we know this sound. It's like cicadas and bush noise and, you know, the rustling of leaves. You know, if you ever go out to the wilderness anywhere in the world, it has a distinct kind of wilderness sound to it. And it's very well known here. They said that's not what this was. This was something completely different. Others reported strange phenomena like impressions of space or time warps upon the property, where a particular locality would change in perspective. And that kind of goes back to what was being described by Graham when he looked at the sky. He said the entirety of the sky itself was kind of shifting. Well, it seems like this particular location, it's like a magnetically or, I don't know, like energetically active location, which is causing this. Because apparently some of the witnesses said the landscape would quiver and shift around when being viewed by the witnesses, and then the shifting location would just suddenly return to normal. But it could be seen as some type of portal location, which would be consistent, though, if this is like an energetically permeable area, for example, much like, you know, Point Pleasant, which John Keel was talking about, window areas, these sorts of locations. Maybe this particular area was one of these window locations. It may still be. I think window locations, though, are connected with other things. I don't know whether it's solar activity. I don't know if it's geomagnetic activity, pole shift. I don't know. But I think that these window areas, they do pop up. And you do have these locations that have the activity going on, but they move. Like it moves, because think about it. If it's energetic, it moves about. So
seasonal.
It's seasonal. Exactly. It might even be cyclic, though, as well. But this is why we can never pin this stuff down. It's like Bigelow put all that money into Skinwalker Ranch to try and research it. I don't know what happened there, but he pulled out. Like, I don't know if he was scared off. I don't know if the activity died.
Yeah, because he reverse engineered the demonic blueprints.
Well, yeah, I don't think that's what happened.
He
I
built
think he
the hypercube in his underground base.
But didn't his wife die?
I have no idea.
And I wonder if that was more like connected to this kind of stuff. But going back to this Mount Butler area, Bill writes, look, the Mount Butler area seems to be the focus of strange and possibly paranormal phenomena. It's a locality which has qualified me as another Australian UFO hot zone. And of course, you know, he says some of these other locations are places like Tully in North Queensland. We're talking about the saucer flap that was up there and the Blue Mountains. One other location is the Grampians, which is, again, another mountainous kind of region with high levels of quartz and stone. Wycliffe Well and Toowoomba, which is out to the west of us here, Ben. He says
there's weird stuff in Toowoomba.
Yeah, yeah. But he says none of this came close to the intensity of personal experiences that I underwent during the 1973 Tyringham flap, which is the one that you mentioned earlier.
Oh, that's the one I've just had flashed up on the screen.
Right, yeah. So look, I'll link to this particular post so you can go through because he does have a selection of events that occurred here. There's one that I will highlight here. Let me just bring this up for you. I think that was the image that you showed there, Ben. But he says you've got Marwin, Jill, Sandra, and Warwick. They were driving out behind Bonnie Mountain. This is following a sheep station road. They said that they came to what they assumed was a landing area. They noticed that their compass was spinning wildly. Now, I don't know if they were particularly looking, chasing after something in this one of these particular areas, but they said they were checking the immediate area using their spotlights. They said there was nothing found. They drove on and their compass returned to normal, so they returned to Tyringham. A subsequent check in the area indicated no effects in the marine compass, but there were observations of strange activity that was occurring in this landing zone. Some people had indeed seen things land in fields around here, but no estimates can be made to the size of these particular objects. But the fact that their compasses were affected in itself suggests that there is some type of, an energetic effect which is taking place here. And then the article just goes on and on and on and on. There's a whole collection of things. You've got Dorothy said that she would have a feeling of dreaming, like she would look out her window and dream and would get the impression of a country scene in grassed bushland. So it's like this weird perception change that would go on. She would see missiles soaring into the sky.
Huh?
So it's like she's being shown
this, ghost rockets.
Yeah, like this weird kind of effect on and on. I don't know what's going on here. Jump over to that article and have a look for yourself. Of course, yeah, I'll link to it. So much more in there.
And they were all worshipping Satan on the weekend.
No. But you do have to wonder, right? You do have to wonder. But we're running a little bit long. I'm just going to see.
Yeah, we're running a little bit long.
Because I've got so many more examples of this actually to highlight these experiences. So let me bring up actually some of these experiences. So speaking of these particular zones, right, and these locations which Australia has, I was wondering with Iowa, is there something about this particular location, like the other window areas that we hear, that permit this type of stuff to be taking place? And because it can move, is it that now Iowa in the 2024 period, 2025, 2026, is this a hotbed for other activity? Because I did notice in some MUFON reports, there is a bit of activity taking place over Iowa. Nothing significant.
The entire state.
Of course, yeah. But like, it doesn't have to be localized down to like one particular zone. I think it's a wide net that these things can be captured. But let's look at some of these cases, right? Because we go back to 1983. You've got Russian ufologist Emil Baturin. He claimed that he had seen a purple ball rise out of a thick forest and leave behind a patch of melted snow. When he went and measured this, right, going back to the Chalker report of like that he couldn't work out what the size was, with this one, he said when he measured it, it was 206 feet across.
Okay, that's pretty big.
206 feet. Baturin would also claim that he and his expedition had been chased by orbs of light through the trees that had burnt them with some sort of rays, with which one of the team members said he was knocked unconscious by the lights. Even more intriguing still is there is a case from 2005. So that was 1983 where that took place. This is in the anomalous zone in Russia. This is to the Perm region, right, which is this 45 square kilometer densely forested area. It's always been known as a place full of strangeness and sometimes wonder, but it's really been called the Perm Anomalous Zone. And for centuries, there's been a variety of strange phenomena that which has been emerging from here, but guess what most of it is? It's mysterious lights in the sky, translucent luminescent beings, and dark figures. Much like what was being reported, the initial report from Bill Chalker at Mount Butler was a figure. Mm. Like, it wasn't the UFO. It was a figure of some kind.
Yeah, so, weird that it was a hooded, cowled, monk-like figure.
Yeah. It's connecting this stuff to, like, yeah, it somehow seems like it's UFOs. And people are seeing craft in the sky, but a lot of the time they're seeing balls of light. That's all they're seeing. And then these balls of light morph and change. And then later on, as the flap seems to take off, then you get more specific results of seeing actual source of light craft. And it just makes me think, well, is this what we're hearing with so many of these reports of where people, like, they interact with this stuff and somehow the phenomenon pulls the image from their mind?
They have some kind of expectation of what they're seeing.
Right. And it takes, it's like a delay because they're seeing creatures first. They're not, and they're not even seeing aliens. Like, they're seeing cowled figures. So people don't immediately go to, oh, that's an alien. Like, you'd expect to see, you know, an insect or something that's distinctly not human.
Maybe it is an alien just wearing a hood.
Well, this is my point though. It's like, I don't know, though. I think there's something different that's going on here. But going back...
Can you talk about the chin guy?
I can talk about the chin guy.
Because I saw the image.
So, well, this is the thing, which I'm going to have to do on Tuesday now because I'm realizing I'm running out of time. But I have got a collection of these really old reports of people basically being blasted with UFOs, with beams from UFOs.
I saw this chin guy. I was researching something else weeks ago and I saw the image and I thought the image was so good. It was... worth doing the story just based on the sketch.
Well, I think it's cool because first of all, we talk about people encountering the high collar beings, right?
That's right. Yeah.
But they're normally, they're gray beings. They're normally described as being gray beings wearing these cloak-like uniforms, if you will, that have these very high collars. But this one's a little bit different. This is a humanoid form, but he has an extraordinary long face. He has this large chin that goes all the way. It's like he doesn't have a neck. The chin just goes all the way down to his chest.
He looks like Farquaad from Shrek.
Yeah, he does. Exactly. So this is from August the 28th in 1972. It was 3 a.m. You've got Eduardo Ferrengo de Doug. He was driving to Bahia Blanca in Buenos Aires in Argentina. Apparently, someone on the side of the road, again, on an isolated road, late at night, 3 o'clock in the morning, someone's waving him down for a ride. So, of course, he pulls over and the hitchhiker is standing beside the car and he says, well, where are you going? He says, I'm going to Bahia Blanca, so, you know, would you like to come? The man replies, the hitchhiker replies, but his reply is completely unintelligible.
He's like, gaga blanca,
blanca,
blanca.
He's wearing a coat with a turned up collar and a large round cap. He has a jaw so elongated.
Oh, so that's not a helmet. That's not a helmet. It's like a leather cap.
Yeah, it's like a leather cap. It's almost like an early 1920s aviator cap or something. Maybe a little bit different. Apparently, his jaw was so elongated that it came down almost to his chest. Further efforts to communicate proved to be futile. Apparently, as they neared the city, his car headlights suddenly switched off. Ahead of him is a huge object with a blue light in the middle of the road. It's also got two white lights on either side. He stops his car and steps out. As soon as he steps out of the car, flashes of light strike him and he feels intense heat. He ducks behind his open door, trying to avoid being shot by these beams coming from these lights.
So again, getting struck by the orbs,
getting struck by the orbs, right? He says the object is moving to the left and he doesn't know what's going on. He looks over and the stranger is gone.
Did the driver get abducted? Is there any indication of that?
None of that. He just says the passenger door is open, the handle is broken and lying on the floor. He then spins around to look back at this craft and the object just simply vanishes.
Imagine how awkward the car trip would be with this guy.
Yeah.
Like, see, do you want to listen to the radio or something? He's just staring deadpan straight ahead with his giant chin.
The only thing
his
I could,
little cap on.
The only thing I could think of is like.
So where are you from? What are you been up to? Are you on the way to Blanca for something? He's just nothing. Doesn't give you anything.
Has he gone for like, he's gotten out of the UFO and gone for a walk, but it's just like a little bit too far. He's like, oh shit. Like, I need to get back now. How am I going to get back? So he just like waves down this car. I don't know. I don't know what to think of this. But yeah, I mean, these stories, it's really important to highlight with this stuff is that there are really obscure stories that kind of just sit on the periphery of this phenomenon.
But they have the details that match with the other cases.
Exactly.
And then you think, well, did these witnesses know about all these other cases that had these connections? But it's the 1970s.
Yeah.
It's harder for these sort of stories to spread so quickly and easily like
Correct.
They do today.
Correct.
How did they know these little details?
Exactly. And you've got people, and I'm really glad that I found that Bill Chalker report because you've got people who are on the ground who are investigating these cases and they are the ones that are making these connections. They're going, oh, hang on a second. I had a report where I went. So they know that these people aren't connected. Yeah, they're not colluding. And this is back in the 70s, as you rightly point out. It's like, hang on a second. There's this element, which is of high strangeness, but it's fitting with this report, which is from a different location. How they have... So are people encountering the same beings? Is it we're all being tested by the same phenomenon? You know, what is occurring here? And why is it that people are seeing entities before they're seeing craft? Whereas in many other cases, it's more like they see a craft first and then they see the entities. Many of this stuff... It just doesn't make sense. But at the very least, what it highlights is that there is a danger connected in with this stuff, which is very, very... Oh, you bring this...
Okay, what is this guy? He's got an image of like a little hedgehog man standing in the doorway. So what is this story?
Let me bring this one up. So this was just a throwaway one, but because I've got so much more, but I've just run out of time.
Is
so
he on fire? Is he made of electricity? Like, or is he an actual hedgehog man?
Guess what this is?
Hedgehog man.
No, 1973.
Oh, no way.
It's that year again. It's 1973. It's Albany, Ohio. You've got Mary Geddes. It's October the 16th. She claims that she sees a ghost-like figure floating about 50 feet above the ground at 1,000 feet distance. She says it's 4 feet tall and thin, like a person draped in a close-fitting sheet. So it's kind of like got the... Not a sheet's a little bit different, but almost like this cloaked kind of effect, which is coming up from so many of these reports. It was only seen briefly when she notices a bright white light object moving about and approaches to about 200 feet in front of her before disappearing. She said the object was around 20 feet in diameter, about 25 to 30 feet off the ground, and a very strange experience, right? And that's all she sees. But she's been tagged.
Oh, so this happens later.
Later. She's making dinner when she spins around in her living room, or from her kitchen into her living room, where she sees a little blue-green spiky thing about 2.5 feet tall with a face that looked very, very odd. She said the spiky thing was at the top and it was on the sides of the head. It was looking through an open door. It had stumpy arms and I couldn't see any legs. It quickly disappeared from sight as soon as I looked at it. UFO sightings occur around the same time in Athens, Ohio. Many other reports reported by other people not connected to her, saying that they saw a similar style UFO.
It's literally Sonic the Hedgehog.
Well, this is a great example, though. While this case is only short, this is a really great example of what I've been trying to get across here, is that you don't want to summon this stuff in. All she did, she wasn't interested in UFOs. She wasn't using an Ouija board. She wasn't looking for these things. She wasn't even thinking about UFOs. Like Bill Chalker wasn't even thinking about them. But she looks up into the night sky and sees something, and then later on the thing is in her house. It's like, why on earth would you think it's a good idea to summon these things, to bring them into your world? Because ultimately it just ends up, like the Orb book, really destroying a large part of your life.
I don't know. This guy seems kind of cool. Like I'd want to hang out with him.
No, Ben, did you not listen to what I just said? You don't
I wasn't really listening.
You don't want
I just wanted to hang out with a little blue hedgehog spiky guy.
I'm sure they seem all sweet and nice when they're standing in your door while you're making dinner, but like after the sun goes down, who knows what's going
on? Imagine like he turns up on Halloween and he wants to hang out with you and you just take him to a party dressed up.
Yeah, and then he electrocutes everyone there.
Dr. Robotnik, and you've got this little spiky blue guy with you. It's like, what's your costume,
man? You're trying really hard to go to Halloween as, with Sonic, aren't you? I can see what you're doing here. Look, but I'll go into more of these cases because I want to continue this. I'll go into more of this on Tuesday of these relatively obscure cases, but have these stunning parallels between them. And then I actually want to connect it back to, I found some obscure reports actually of where it's like, it's very modern and very academic to like throw in the whole like the cultural relevance of the interpretation of the introspection of UFO. I'm just like, I don't care about any of that shit. I found a collection of cases from Africa where people in Africa are experiencing very similar to reports to what people in the West are experiencing. And they're obviously interpreting it through their, spirituality and superstitions.
Yeah.
But they're describing the same stuff that people are seeing in the West, except they're describing it as demons and jinn and high strangeness beings, as opposed to it being UFOs. But it always comes back to lights in the sky.
Mm.
So we'll go into that on Tuesday, but you've got more coming up in the Plus Extension as well.
Yeah, more coming up. Also, breaking on this episode, the entire state of Iowa is a paranormal zone. High strangeness.
I'm saying if you were to apply like a hotspot of activity, I'm sure you would find plenty of it around that area. It might flow into Illinois. It might fall into Kansas.
If you live in that state, get out now. It's more coming up on this episode. We're going to be looking at Otto Rahn. Where's my cover of the book?
Just say it. Gay Nazis.
Richard Stanley, Otto Rahn, Grail Hunter, The Secret of the Cathars and the Return of the White Lady. The start of a potential, well, I think it'll definitely be a two-parter because it's a huge story. But we're going to start the story in our Plus extension coming up. If you want to get access to that, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Take a look at our premium subscriptions. We've been doing this for a while, so there's a huge back catalog. If you sign up for our Emmy Max tier, you get access to the entire back catalog going back years and years and years and years and years. But if you just want to get access to our Plus shows that come out every single Tuesday, and of course the big extensions we do on these shows every single Friday, it's $9 a month, so you can help support your favorite show. Check out our Plus membership, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. You also get an ad-free version of the show and a higher quality MP3. All the details are there. Make sure you check it out. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus extension. Great to have you.